The following was recorded on July 7th, 2007, at ReaderCon 18 in Burlington, Massachusetts. Jim Freund, who hosts the radio show Hour of the Wolf on 99.5 FM WBAI in New York City, graciously provided this recording for us. Thank you, Jim. Well, thank you for coming. This is the Sybil's Garage reading. We're going to be hearing stories from John Bowker, Leah Bobbitt, and Barbara Krasnov, reading from the stories that are in the latest issue of Sybil's Garage, Sybil's Garage number 4. You can check us out online at census5.com, S-E-N-S-E-S-F-I-V-E.com. My name is Matthew Kressel, and I'm the publisher and editor of Sybil's Garage. And a couple of the editors are here in the audience as well. Mercurio Rivera and Paul Berger help me edit the magazine. So we're going to hear three stories today, and we're going to start with John Bowker. John's short fiction has appeared recently in On Spec, Andromeda Spaceways In Flight magazine, and the Sex and the System anthology. He's an MFA candidate at Emerson College, and he might or might not be wearing socks at this reading for reasons that will soon become apparent. Here's John.
This piece is titled Pairings. In the waning light of a winter afternoon, Catherine cloistered herself in the window seat, determined to repair all the black socks. That was no small task. Her tangled piles were studies in every gradation of age and dark, threadbare wool, slick dress black nylon, the odd navy blue confusing things. She had combed the house to find them, searching under every bed, behind every sofa, excavating bins of forgotten clothing from beneath the fading boxes of old wedding presents in the attic. The sunlight shone horizontal through the window, illuminating the rime and warming her fingers as she balled each pair with a sure movement. Every scrap before her had a mate, animus to anima. On that day, she intended to reunite them all. Michael had left early, working on a Saturday again. She didn't know which color socks he had worn, and he wasn't careful with his choices. He might have even worn the socks from two different pairs. She yearned to ask him, but his office phone returned only 12 rings and his voice on the machine, a promise to return her call. Maybe that was for the best, she told herself. Michael had little patience with her tiny projects, her homely concerns. Nobody's paying attention, Catherine, he'd say with a shake of his head at her foolishness. Nobody cares. Maybe it was just that he didn't care. Certainly not about anything she wore, and he rarely needed anything more than casual clothing for work himself. Unless he wanted to impress someone, he wore socks to match, an endless stream of white sweat socks, of which any one was the mate of any other. When they met, she loved him for that. His white socks had reminded her of childhood freedoms, summer in sneakers, canvases upon which adventures could be writ large in mud and bicycle grease and the occasional blood of a skinned knee. Purchased in packages of a dozen, they were interchangeable, benign, like promises. She didn't know it then, but black socks are different. Black socks know little pleasure in their short lives. The forced silence of family dinners and funerals, visits to the physician, uncomfortable afternoons with a man who tells you the key to marriage is communication. Humorless and sullen, they absorb it all. Unable to stand even their own company, they separate from the pack, sinking deep into their misery in the silt behind the clothes dryer, pushing far into the underneath of beds to lie with the dust mice and take mean pleasure in nightmares. Alone and solitary, they are no threat. A basket of black socks, however, that is something else. The hair was curly and blonde, tangled in the weave of the sock at the very bottom of the basket. Grabbed tight during a stay on a particular floor, on a particular afternoon, as Catherine's pile grew, it was passed through the slow tectonics of fabric to the surface. Against the dark background, it glowed to winter Saturday eyes like the chain Michael had given her on their first anniversary, the one that had looked so pretty against the raven's wing of her long, dark hair. When Michael came through the door that night, the first thing Catherine threw was a bald black sock. But there were heavier things to follow.
Thank you, John. Next we hear from Leah Bobbitt. Leah lives in Toronto, where she studies linguistics and works in Canada's oldest science fiction bookstore. Her fiction has appeared in Realms of Fantasy, Strange Horizons, and several Year's Best collections. and her poetry has been nominated for the Riesling and Pushcart prizes.
Sorry. There we go. Okay, this is called After the War. After the war, after the toil, you will not be welcomed home. That's what the drill sergeant, the recruitment officer, the man who became your lieutenant, told you that first day in the forces. You will sweat and ache, cry and bleed, and they will not welcome you home. You didn't care. You were young, dedicated to the cause. The war needed fighting. There was a duty to be done. Your convictions would carry you through. You were young. And so you kept silent as they told you to look right, look left, for one of those two people would not make it home. You kept silent as they described the hardship of life overseas, the loneliness, the pain and futility of it all. You signed your name on the dotted line and swore your allegiance to the flag. You were young. And now, it is after the war. You have served with distinction, forged lifelong bonds, made it home alive to your family and town and the woman you love, and they have not welcomed you home. While you were gone, surrounded by blood and ammo and hot sun and hate, the mood on the home front shifted. People no longer support the war. People marched in the streets, accused your government of killing you for an unjust cause. Later, people called you murderers, participants in a conspiracy to rob a nation of riches and dignity. You knew none of this. Your only care, off in a distant nation where nobody spoke your language, was the strangling loneliness of the war. After the war, nobody meets your eye in town. They spit on the street when you pass. Nobody thanks you for the sacrifice you have made to keep them safe. 4 years of your life without wife and family, 4 years of death and dying and nightmares you still wake up from screaming every night. She doesn't know how to handle it, and you can't explain. She doesn't understand how things worked in the war. You've changed, she says, and there are tears in her eyes. You came back different. You still haven't come back. You're half a world away. You dream of killing and dying and being thankful for every pockmarked sunrise. But it wasn't you who changed. They changed while you were gone. You dream of it at night. You dream of her, beckoning dirt death brown fingernails, kukri knife teeth, her touch burning acid holes around your throat. Her whisper is seductive in the way that the familiar entices. The familiarity is revolting and turns your stomach. The dreams wake your wife. She looks at you sleepy, agonized, and you almost shy away from her touch in those first moments between waking and sleeping. The tension rips you fine and painful, pulling away, pulling close to her for comfort. In the bars, late afternoon, you all stare into your drinks, stare at each other, try not to speak about the tendrils of dream still curled around your throats. You try not to speak. One day, your wife comes home with plane tickets in her hand. We're going back, she says, you and me. Your reaction is near violence. You do not want her to go there, your wife who is so small and strong and fragile all at the same time. You went so she wouldn't know hunger, disease, pain. You lost yourself for that. We're going, she insists. I'm not spending my life avoiding this. I'm going, and I'm bringing you back home. You board a plane. It takes off. You dream and scream and frighten the stewardesses. And it sets back down. After the war, it is still a place of stench, of poverty, of anarchy, of death. A year later, you can't tell what the war did for the people here. Then, you were on a mission of liberation. Things were going to be different, ugly now, but it would improve the lives of millions. You were doing good work. You were young. You beg your wife not to stay. You can change your tickets, go to Italy or France or Scotland, see the sights for a week, relearn the rhythms of each other's company. Maybe it was the transition. Maybe you need a change of scene. Anything but this, you finally whimper, but she is adamant. She will see what you see. She will go where you went, even if she must walk cloaked and covered here so the locals don't jeer at her bleach blonde hair. She will understand. You give in. You take her out to the ruins of the base camp. The creature is still there. After the war, she is still monstrous. Her eyes are black pits, her skin blood red, her torso draped with ropes of skulls that do not conceal the spike-sharp black nipples which weep blood and pus and shit night and day. She is sinuous, vicious, smiling through sharp teeth. She is birth and love and death, and the cord trailing from her belly is still wrapped tight around your throat. She is hot as the desert and just as sterile, and the sight of her is terrifying and comforting and makes you want to run. You bury your face in between your wife's breasts. You inhale her smell deep, the smell of woman and home. You pray. Your wife cradles you like a mother, comforting, soft, but she raises her voice like a warrior. The war is over, she says. Let him go. Let my lover go. The monster laughs. It is jackboots on glass, on broken stone, on the debris of smiling statues. The war is never over. The war never ends. It does. It has. He's not yours anymore, your wife says. And you can't understand how her voice is so strong and calm. The hips of the monster give birth to landmines. Each finger ends in a tiny pistol. There are pestilential sores on her thighs and lice crawling on her arms. They are always mine, the monster says. And her laugh is the whine that the missiles made a moment before they hit, the whine that told you to run as fast as you could if you wanted to make it home after the war. Her arms are opened at the wrist. Thick black smoke drifts from the long stigmata. I can wait. You shudder, because it's true, it's true. But your wife does not droop and wilt or surrender. Then I'll go to him. Tell me about the war, your wife says. Make me understand so he'll love me again. No, you say. You joined up to spare her this, and yet a tiny voice in the back of your throat, a whimper, a wail. Understand me, love me again, thank me, respect me, I did this for you. Liar, the blood-brown dirt beneath your boots whispers, and you start to weep. You didn't know. You're crying because you didn't know. How could you know what it was like? You were innocent. You were young. Now you're 1,000 years old. You never asked those who fought the last war what that was behind their eyes, that darkness that never went away even when they smiled. It didn't matter to you because it was after the war. The war was over. So, no, you say again. Take me home. It's all right again, even though it isn't. You turn your back on the monster, even though you can feel the umbilical cord from her belly connected to a million souls, to your soul, drawing you back through the plane trip home over ocean and plains and mountains, tying you to her for the rest of your life. You lie, and you smile, and you make love to your wife slowly and not in the fervent, frightened, rough way you have since the end of the war. You learn the motions of what's expected, and she settles down. The worry smooths from her face, and the household is at peace once again. After the war, you are always a battlefield. Need and necessity, desire and duty, the reason you said you went and the reason you really did, tramp over you in formation, each gaining and giving ground in turn. Your children see it and grow up pacifists. They know from the tilt of your head, the shuffle in your step, that war is a terrible thing. There are questions, even grown, that they never ask. After the war, you put on your uniform for Veterans Day and march to the town square, where times have changed again and the bitterness has been forgotten. Trumpets blare, drums pound, speeches ring out through afternoon air, praise you for serving your country, for doing your duty, for sacrifice, for courage, for high-mindedness. You stand in rows, each old soldier wearing the blank face, the blank eyes, that keep the war fenced in behind your teeth. Paper rustles. Flags wave. The crowd rises to sing. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Wow. The last but not least, we have Barbara Krasnoff. Barbara has published stories in Weird Tales, Descent, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Amazing Stories, and two anthologies, Such a Pretty Face, Tales of Power, and Abundance and Memories and Visions, Women's Fantasy and Science Fiction. She's also the author of Robots, Reel to Reel, a book on robotics for young adults. By day, she's reviews editor for InformationWeek.com, a well-known tech publication, and by night, she hangs out in Brooklyn, New York, with her partner in crime, Jim Freund.
means of communication. In a circle of chairs, their backs straight and voices intent, the heroes discuss the day's findings, review their videos carefully, listen to their recordings, and enter their notes. They are tall, lean, clear-faced, bodies tight with exercise and good health, intelligence shining out of kindly eyes. Their voices rise and fall in a quiet, harmonious flow. I let myself float on a river of sound that means little to me. Occasionally, one looks over at me, sitting silently in my corner, and asks solicitously whether I am comfortable, whether I have enough light, enough to eat and drink. I nod, they nod, and ignore me again. We are all happier that way. Technically, I am also part of this project, this great adventure in which the human race takes the first tentative steps towards communication with an alien society. The station is bright and austere. The important sections, the labs and the engines and the control center and the airlock, are cared for by those who run those systems. There are robots to rumble over the landscape and take pictures, to repair a broken antenna or build an observation blind. But it is almost impossible for a robot to make a good hospital corner, and even Einstein needed somebody to mend his socks, to make his bed and make sure there was heat in the morning. That is my job. I attend to the living quarters, the common rooms, and the kitchen. I am not allowed in the other areas unless my duties take me there. They tell me that this prevents me from experiencing any unnecessary stress. And that is important for someone with my history. Some of it I can remember at night when I'm in bed and my mind wanders from the tasks of the day into its own secret pathways. I recall lying on a soft rug in a bright room, watching the play of sun on the walls, but not yet knowing the words in which to describe what I am watching, and sitting in a schoolroom, surrounded by bright playthings and vibrant children, hesitantly touching a synthesizer and listening to the sounds it creates, and walking down a long hallway, angry about something bad that was going to happen. That is the one I come back to most often. But these memories are few and far between. Most are hidden from me, buried in a place where I have been made afraid to search. We have not erased your former self, the doctors told me. We have only buried it where it won't disturb you. Before we helped you, you were angry and destructive. You destroyed other people's peace and made them uncomfortable. Now you are free of those hateful behaviors and thoughts. Once you're one with yourself, once you are completely open to the love and the trust of others, you will be able to heal yourself of everything that we have had to bury, and your memories will return. This is what they have told me. I have tried so hard to follow their advice. I do my work faithfully. I smile at the heroes and try not to let anything wrong or hard enter my thoughts. But whenever I sit quietly and try to find the place where they have hidden my past, my stomach recoils, and I must back away and turn my attention to my tasks. Sometimes I send a message to the doctors and ask them how long it will take. But the people in the return messages only smile gently and tell me that it will take as long as it takes. I have asked to talk to those who, like me, have had their pasts shrunk down and hidden somewhere in their mind, but who finally succeeded, made peace with themselves, and regained access to their memories. But the doctors tell me that the secrets of those others are their own. You would not, they ask, smiling, want others to know of your past, would you? I don't know. I no longer know what that past is, and they won't tell me. If I think about it anymore, I become disturbed and sick, proving, says the doctor, that they were right and that I'm not ready. So I service the station, use the equipment that cleans and mends and cooks for the heroes who explore this world and study its inhabitants. They have told me that I am a hero too, that without my help, the clean-faced and clear-eyed people could not do their jobs in comfort and with confidence. But I don't feel like a hero. Sometimes I wonder if I would have been content with this work 3 years ago when I was caught and arrested and convicted of something. but I have no way of knowing. Sometimes when I am cleaning, a tune comes to me and I begin to hum it. But before I can remember the words to the song, my stomach tightens, my face grows hot, and I have to pull away from whatever has been planted in my mind. I can't complain, though. I am fed well and cared for. Everyone has a kind word for me at the end of the day, when we sit in the lounge and look at the recordings of the aliens. We can't just keep calling them aliens, argues the linguist, a tall, thin man with hard eyes. For one thing, it is inaccurate. These are the natives of this planet. We are the aliens here. We shouldn't call them aliens. It promotes a condescending attitude toward them. They should have a name. But that is the problem, says the red-haired man, who is the leader of the expedition. Like T.S. Eliot's cats, these beings have several names. He counts them off on his fingers. There is the scientific name that tells us they are biped lizards with opposing thumbs. There are the various names given to them by an eager media that tell us they are weird but possibly intelligent and not to be hated. There are the nicknames we've given them, trying to make them nameable and therefore understandable. And there is the name that they alone know for themselves. He stops counting and smiles. And until we know that name, then aliens is as good an appellation as any. But we may never know their real name. The aliens are small, bright-eyed, active. They have towns and processions and schedules. They are, no doubt, intelligent. Yet there is no language that can be deciphered by our scientists. The sounds they make, when they make them, seem random and without substance, while the gestures made by their two sets of arms and hands are not elaborate enough to indicate coherent meaning. For several months now, the heroes have gone out with their recorders and equipment and carefully, patiently studied the aliens. We have watched them form small, quiescent worms, harvest them, and eat them. We have filmed them as they sit like stones under the sun, occasionally moving their heads to study the sky and the ground. We've even been able to record the way the aliens are born, reproduce, as slowly as turtles and with less enthusiasm, and die. But with all the research and all the hours of hidden watching, there has still been no breakthrough, no way to decipher the system by which these small lizards make themselves understood to each other. They seem to ignore each other and us. Perhaps they don't feel the need to communicate in any traditional sense, says a tall, pale woman who sometimes offers me hard, sweet candies that she brought from home. There could be an innate understanding there that doesn't require a language. But they cooperate, answers the red-haired man. I don't think he likes me. My presence seems to make him uneasy. A society at that level with family groups and even a low level of manufacturing, they do, after all, create tools and homes, must communicate in some fashion. Telepathy? Someone suggests. There are several groans, quickly stifled. I sit in back and listen to the voices of the aliens as the tape plays. They sound like pigeons, making contented cooing noises that, according to the heroes, don't have any meaning. But the sounds are pretty. Sometimes one of the aliens screams, and the others all stop for a moment and look and stamp their feet and then go about their business. That is pretty, too. Although, according to the heroes, they scream and the stamps are random and therefore meaningless. We've gone over this before, says the tall woman. Their brains simply do not function at a level that would indicate telepathy. We have examined that possibility thoroughly, and it is simply out of the question. Nothing is totally out of the question, another counters, and they are off again. They never raise their voices, never yell or hit the furniture in frustration, never let their hands punctuate a point. They just smile and speak softly. It would be terrible to let a rude or loud word escape. I am told that I must avoid stress if I am to open myself to myself. Yet the tension that fills those quiet, controlled bodies would, I think, power the entire station. Usually I sip and listen and allow the words that I don't understand to float past my head. But today it has been different. Something is changing. It hurts to feel the stress rise in the room. The quiet river of sounds doesn't carry me anymore. I try to concentrate on the sounds the aliens make on the recording, but even that doesn't help. Finally, I slowly stand and walk through the doorway. and fortunately I am noticed. A few paces into the corridor, and I am stopped by a soft voice speaking my name. I turn and see a short young man with smooth, dark skin. He is new here. He arrived yesterday with the supply ship. "Why are you leaving?" he asks. "Are you ill?" "No," I tell him, wishing he hadn't asked, but knowing I have to answer. "I just wanted to leave." He cocks his head to the side, very much like a bird. "Yes, I noticed that you didn't say anything all evening. Are you shy? Do you dislike groups?" I have nothing to say. The young man's smile is lovely. "Oh, I can't believe that," he says. "Everyone here has something they can contribute. Why would you think..." The red-haired man, who has followed us out of the corridor, bends over the young man's shoulder and whispers in his ear. The young man stiffens and his eyes drop. "Oh," he says, suddenly hesitant, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I hope I didn't make you feel..." His voice trails off and the two men both stare at me. I wish I knew what they saw. But I don't want to embarrass anyone, especially members of the team. I had been warned by my doctor that this might happen. "We know that you are better and happier now that we have shut away your bad self," she told me several times, so I would remember. "But there are those out in the world who are disturbed, even upset, by the methods used to heal you. Of course, it is not your fault that they are upset, and you should not be bothered by this. But you should do what you can to minimize their distress, as we should all try to help minimize the distress of those around us, and we will teach you how to do this properly." So I smile at the young man and shrug my shoulders and say, "Please don't be distressed on my account. I am perfectly happy with my life, much happier than I was before, I promise you. I have practiced very hard to combine the words with the actions so that they work well, and I am pleased to see that all my training has been successful." The young man smiles back, his eyes return to mine, and he says, "Of course, my mistake, please excuse me," and immediately turns back to the room. But the red-haired man stays. He doesn't smile. He just looks at me for a moment, then raises his hand and touches my cheek. "I'm so sorry," he whispers. "When I called them, when I reported you, I didn't know they would..." His voice dies away, and he stands there waiting for... what? This isn't the first time he's talked to me like this. I don't want to make him feel sad or uncomfortable, but nothing I was taught seems to help. The only thing I can do is smile and stand and wait until he drops his hand and, without saying anything else, goes back to join the other heroes. The voices swell again, and I walk down the corridor, leaving them behind. Just past the living quarters, in a small wing that flares out from the outer shell of the station, is the airlock that leads outside. This is an area that is normally forbidden to me, and for the first 2 months of my stay here, I walked around the entrance, anxious to avoid the unease that hits my stomach whenever I go near that which is prohibited. But then there was an accident. One of the heroes snagged her suit on a sharp rock, cutting her foot and exposing her to whatever disease could be hidden in the depths of the mineral. They rushed her back to the station, removed her suit, and enclosed her in a bubble, hiding her in the sick bay until they were sure she was once again clean and bright. They would have sent one of the robots into the airlock to clean the blood and dispose of the suit, but then they would have had to dispose of the robot, and none could be spared. So they finally gave me a suit so that I would be safe, and said it was all right for me to enter the airlock and scrub the floor. Nobody said, only this once. Nobody told the ship that I should not be allowed outside. So now, while the others are discussing their experiments and preparing for bed and deciding who they will sleep with this night, I enter the lock. I put my suit on carefully and check the helmet and filter, the way it says to on the safety display, and attach the heavy boots to the shining pants so that I can walk without bouncing off the surface. And I go for a walk. I don't remember much about home, but I know it is nothing like this. The star that lights this planet is golden, red-tinged, and the plants that cover the rocky ground shine dark green and purple. They are soft under my heavy boots, and as I step, tiny, translucent creatures scurry away from my tread to hide under other rocks, other plants. It takes 15 minutes to walk to the alien town. Our base is far enough, I have been told, so that our presence doesn't disturb their lives, but close enough for rescue in case of an emergency. Like the insects, the aliens live in shimmering green rocks, or rather in large caves built of rocks over which plants have been carefully tended. They wriggle out of entrances dug into the soft ground and stand around me, their bright multiple eyes reflecting the red gold of the sun, now low on the horizon. They don't smile. They don't tell me how lucky I am. They don't ask me how I am doing. They just stare at me, and I stare back. Suddenly one screams, and the others stamp their feet against the hard ground in a cadence that I can feel shivering through my feet and up my spine, again and again, in strange patterns that I try to follow but always lose. Another screams. The sound pierces my head and makes everything bright, so bright that for a moment I can't see. Stamp, stamp, until I vibrate with the rhythm, until my sight returns, everything sharp and clear in the golden sunlight. Then I stamp too, and I scream. That goddamn suit is in the way, so I pull off my gloves, remove the helmet. I clap my hands and sing the raw living music that pushes through me. My head hurts, my stomach heaves, my programming screams stop, but I don't care. I cry, I scream, and I sing. I sing for the music that once was my life. I sing for the man who betrayed me and who now mourns for what was lost. You're wrong, I scream. It's not lost. It's here, it's all here, and you can't have it. The music, the words, the crowds, the audiences, the anger and the beauty. I remember, and I scream, and I sing. I offer it to the sun and the rocks and the aliens dance.
You're as impressed with the three readers as I am. I don't leave yet. I have bookmarks to give everybody, and also I'd like to open it up for questions if you want, and we can just talk. So, other than that,
bookmarks.
Okay, I got a question for you.
Sure.
But I'll ask you to get behind the microphone area.
Okay.
What outside of simply the collection being what it is that we can hear the different writers and the poetry and all that, and triangulate and say, this is it. How would you describe the editorial focus of Sybil's Garage?
Well, I think we have several editors here. I mean, I'm the editor-in-chief, but I have seven. With this issue, we had seven editors total, and so it was a group selection process. But I think ultimately there was very strongly character-oriented stories. I think all three stories represented that, and stories with a kind of dark, brooding quality, like this undercurrent of a very strong emotion that's trying to surface. But we're really open, you know, to all types of fiction. For example, in this issue, Samantha Henderson has a story about an event at Disney World, a very sort of strange, not necessarily speculative event that happened with two Goofies imitating one another, because it's this heinous, absolutely terrible thing in Disney World to have two characters, identical characters, in the same place at the same time, because the children's heads will explode.
What?
So,
not literally.
Not literally. Well,
story.
No, but so the Goofies mirror one another perfectly to fool the kids into thinking it's all just a big show. Wonderful story. So yeah, I mean, we're not only looking for those types of stories. And I should add that on Tuesday, for those of you who are writers, on Tuesday we're opening to submissions for the next issue. So the URL is actually on the bookmark. So, all right, well, anything you guys want to say? Well, I just want to say thank you, and thank you to the writers, and thank you to my editors, Paul Berger, Mercurio Rivera, Eugene Myers, Devin Poor, Greer Woodward, Lauren McLaughlin, who's not here. Did I miss anybody? I hope not. Chris Dykman for doing some of the graphic art, just really everyone who's helped, and just most of all, I just want to thank the writers for sending their stuff to us. It's fantastic stuff, and I hope those of you who write here will send us your stuff. We'd love to see it. So, thank you.